Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Atheists, agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
The government, hug the government, love. The government, hug the government, love. The government, hug the government.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Northern Kentucky University political scientist Michael Baranowski. Puerto Rico has been a U.S. territory for 125 years. And while the 3.2 million Puerto Ricans are U.S. citizens, they're treated differently because of that territorial status. Now, some believe that Puerto Ricans have been in limbo long enough. The Puerto Rico Status Act, which was introduced in the U.S. House of Representatives last year, calls for a plebiscite in which the people of Puerto Rico would choose between independence, sovereignty, and free association with the United States, or statehood. The legislation has 93 sponsors, including 12 Republicans, and the companion bill in the Senate has 23 sponsors, 22 Democrats, as well as independent Bernie Sanders. So should Puerto Rico be a state? Is there good reason to change the longstanding status quo? These are important questions, and today I'm joined by an expert who's given these questions a lot of careful consideration. That is George Laws Garcia, a former acting director of the Puerto Rico Federal Affairs Administration and executive director of the Puerto Rico Statehood Council. George, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. I greatly appreciate the invitation to be here with you.
So I thought we'd start with just a little bit about you. I mentioned a few things there, but could you just talk a little bit about your background and your expertise on this issue?
Sure. So I was born and raised in Puerto Rico and came to the States at 18, did my BA at University of Chicago, master's degree in American University. And I entered a career of public service. I did some work in nonprofit. And then since then, I've worked for two governors of Puerto Rico, a Republican, Luis Fortuño, and a Democrat, Ricardo Rosselló. I also worked in Congress in the office of the Resident Commissioner of Puerto Rico, which is the only non-voting member of Congress that represents the U.S. citizens on the island, and briefly in one federal agency, U.S. Department of Commerce. And throughout that whole time, I've been very passionate about addressing this issue of resolving Puerto Rico's unequal and undemocratic territory status. And when I left government, I essentially got the opportunity to become the first executive director of the Puerto Rico Statehood Council. And we are a nonprofit 501c4 nonpartisan organization based in Washington, D.C., and our mission is to advance full equality and democracy for the U.S. citizens of Puerto Rico through statehood.
And I read a piece of yours in The Hill not too long ago. And in that, there's something you wrote that I wanted to ask you about. You said that Puerto Ricans have remained disenfranchised and unfairly treated as second-class citizens. And so my question is, well, can you talk a little bit about in what ways you believe that Puerto Ricans are disenfranchised and treated as second-class citizens?
Definitely. So this is really, really important because, unfortunately, the vast majority of our fellow Americans stateside don't really have much awareness of the reality that not just in Puerto Rico, but in the other four U.S. territories, which are Guam, American Samoa, the Commonwealth of Northern Mariana Islands, and U.S. Virgin Islands, there's about 4 million U.S. citizens that every day are subject to federal laws, are subject to the actions that the president and the federal executive branch takes to implement those laws. Yet when it comes time to having a say in making those laws in Congress, they're denied the right to elect voting members of Congress. In the case of the other territories, they elect a non-voting delegate. In the case of Puerto Rico, they call it a resident commissioner. And this person, whose office I worked in a few years ago, they're basically charged with representing the needs and interests of the U.S. citizens of Puerto Rico in Congress, but they can only vote in committee. When it comes to the floor, their vote is symbolic, or they're not allowed to vote at all. And in the case of Puerto Rico, you have a single member who is charged with representing about four times as many citizens as your average House member. And in the Senate, the territories are denied any representation whatsoever. And this Democratic deficit is further compounded by the reality that we also don't have any access to Electoral College votes. So when it comes to the process of electing the president of the United States, U.S. citizens in the territories can vote in presidential primaries, but they can't actually vote in the presidential election and have Electoral College votes represent them in that electoral process. And that means that we are subject to federal laws that we don't really have a say in. And then to make that matter worse, right, to compound that Democratic deficit is the fact that through a series of Supreme Court cases decided over the course of the last century, called the insular cases, and then more recently, a set of cases that has happened that are kind of now being dubbed the new insular cases, Congress has the authority to treat Puerto Rico and the other territories unequally under federal laws with just the barest minimum of justification to meet a constitutional threshold. And that means that the quality of life that U.S. citizens in the territories are facing is considerably lower than that that the rest of Americans are able to have access to living stateside. And not surprisingly, as a result, a lot of people in the territories leave to come stateside because as American citizens, we don't need a green card. We don't need to cross the border. We just get a one-way airplane ticket to Florida, New York, Texas, you know, California, anywhere in the country. And then we are able to gain, you know, full rights as voters and full rights as citizens. And that has had a devastating effect on the island and a huge loss of population.
Yeah, I was wondering specifically about that. I'd never really thought about that to this point, but it would seem to me there's this, sometimes the term is called, you hear this term brain drain, and that the people who oftentimes are in the best position are the ones who end up leaving that bad situation, just essentially making it worse for everyone else. And I'm wondering if that's sort of the dynamic that we've been seeing in Puerto Rico.
In a lot of ways, it is. I mean, we have people leaving the island from all sorts of socioeconomic backgrounds, but many of the people who do leave are highly educated individuals. They're top professionals. And they have not had an equal playing field of opportunities to develop to their full potential in Puerto Rico because the structure of American territorial colonialism is one that is inherently unequal. And that means that if they want to pursue their full development, they can't do so on the island because the island is essentially stuck under this political subordination and disenfranchisement, as well as this, you know, citizen inequality. And it's fascinating because when we look at the Puerto Rican population stateside, which just to give you a comparison, so on the island in Puerto Rico, our peak population in 2000 was about 3.9 million, and it has dropped over the course of the last two decades to 3.2 million. That's the largest population drop of any jurisdiction in the United States in modern history, right? And stateside, the population of Puerto Ricans has grown. And right now, I think there's, you know, close to almost 6 million. I think it's 5.8 or 5.9 million Puerto Ricans living stateside. And if you look at that population of Puerto Ricans living stateside, they have considerably higher levels of income. They have excelled in a number of different, you know, professional endeavors. Just, I think it was last week, we had the second Puerto Rican, you know, inducted as an astronaut into NASA's Corps of Astronauts. So, you know, it's not a lack of capacity and intelligence that our people have. It's a lack of opportunity because of this unequal territorial structure. And that's just devastating. And that needs to change.
And I'm sure one argument you've heard plenty of times is that, well, okay, Puerto Ricans don't have the same representation and so forth, but hey, they also don't pay federal income taxes, and so it all kind of balances out. And I'm sure, like I said, I'm sure you've heard this a bunch. I want to get your take on that, your response to that argument.
Yeah, you know, that argument comes up a lot, and it is fundamentally disingenuous. And I'll tell you why. And to be, you know, clear, it's not just an argument being made by, you know, pundits or politicians that want to deflect from their responsibility to address this issue. This is an argument that the U.S. Department of Justice made in front of the Supreme Court not so long ago. So it's crazy, but our government is arguing this to justify the continuation of this unequal relationship. And the reality is that Puerto Ricans are subject to federal tax laws. People in Puerto Rico pay federal payroll taxes. And even with the programs that are directly funded from those federal taxes, like, for example, Medicare, we don't get equal treatment compared to Medicare recipients in the states, right? So that in and of itself, I think, begins to push back on that argument with a more fully informed factual predicate. The second piece is Puerto Ricans are subject to federal laws in a way that if Congress wanted to, they could impose federal income taxes on Puerto Rico tomorrow, and the residents on the island would have absolutely no say in being able to either support that or stop that, right? So we're being subjected to this unequal treatment on this all these federal laws and programs. They're using the justification that we're not paying federal income taxes, but we're not giving our consent to any of these things. And the fundamental value that is at the heart of America's constitutional structure and the reason why America declared independence from, you know, Britain was precisely because we wanted a government by the consent of the governed, and that is being denied to the U.S. citizens of Puerto Rico.
In fact, when you were saying that, I was thinking no taxation without representation. And boy, this is... So I mentioned in the intro this legislation that really presents actually three options here. And I was hoping you could... statehood, I think, is the one we talk about a lot. Before we get to that, there are these other options that are mentioned in this proposed plebiscite. Independence and something called sovereignty and free association. And honestly, I have no idea what those two things would entail. So could you give us a sense of what those options are and why you believe that statehood is really the best of those three options?
Definitely. So if we look back at American history, the framers of the Constitution, soon after the founding of the Republic, were confronted with a reality that there were a number of territories that were essentially part of, you know, the growing United States at the time that they wanted to expand into. And as part of a process of kind of recognizing that these places that weren't yet states needed to be governed in a way that would essentially prepare them for statehood, because keeping them as jurisdictions that didn't have any government by consent of the governed was against their, you know, fundamental values, they established something called the Northwest Ordinance, which basically set up the process to recognize that the new territories that were being acquired were all in a process that would eventually lead to statehood. Now, when the United States acquired Puerto Rico, as well as Guam and the Philippines during the Spanish-American War in 1898, the Supreme Court was basically faced with a set of cases that I mentioned earlier, insular cases, which brought up questions about whether the U.S. Constitution should apply fully to these, you know, unique and different jurisdictions that were, you know, geographically separate from the contiguous United States, but also significantly filled with large populations of people who spoke foreign languages that weren't commonly spoken in the United States, and also came from different racial and ethnic backgrounds. And essentially, what the Supreme Court decided in that process is to create and make up So they essentially legislated from the bench a new category that you can't find anywhere in the Constitution called non-incorporated territories, right? So they assumed that all of the territories that operated under the Northwest Ordinance then that were brought into the United States before 1898 were quote unquote incorporated, meaning that they were eventually destined to statehood and that they were inherently a part of the United States. And this theory of territorial non-incorporation, which was fundamentally based on racist assumptions about the incapacity of these other jurisdictions to ever really be able to govern themselves in a way that was aligned with or could be compatible with, at those times, the Anglo-Saxon forms of government. And they were considered alien races, right? What they did was they put them in this category of territorial non-incorporation, which means that technically they belong to but are not a part of the United States. In other words, it's a real estate category. And the problem with that is that they're also filled with people. In the case of the Philippines, what this meant was that, and in the case of Puerto Rico and the other territories, there was the option for, you know, independence and separation. So Congress has a disposition in the Constitution, the territorial clause. And in that territorial clause, not only does Congress have the power to make, quote unquote, all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory, which allows them to treat the territories unequally, but they also have the capacity to dispose of the territories. And that is where the potential for independence comes in. In the case of the Philippines, you know, the Filipino people pretty much from the outset did not want to be a part of the United States. They wanted their own independence. They had fought a revolution against Spain. And soon after the United States took over for many years, you know, there was an active, you know, violent revolution against U.S. military governance there. And ultimately, after many decades, the U.S. granted independence to the Philippines. And independence means exactly what it sounds like. You're a fully sovereign, separate country outside of the Constitution of the United States. And the United States can maintain a relationship with you based on international treaties like it does with any other country anywhere else in the world. Now, that is still a possibility for Puerto Rico and the other territories because the Supreme Court put us in this category of territorial non-incorporation. Now, the Sovereignty and Free Association, which is mentioned in the bill, is actually a political status that is essentially a form of separate sovereignty. In other words, as far as I'm concerned, it is another form of independence. And we have that relationship with three jurisdictions in the Pacific right now, which are Palau, the Federated States of Micronesia, and the Marshall Islands. And these jurisdictions were former UN trust territories the United States gained control over during and after World War II. And then after it became clear that the immediate threats from the war were over, America essentially moved to establish a relationship of free association, meaning that those countries became fully independent. They established their own constitution, they have their own president, and they have their own separate citizenship, but they have close ties with the United States, where the United States basically has the responsibility to protect them militarily and also has the right to deny access to any potential foreign adversaries in the region from coming onto those jurisdictions in order to kind of gain a further foothold in the Pacific. And obviously, all eyes were on China when looking at at that potential risk and threat there. So that is what free association is. It is a foreign country the United States has a very close treaty with. They give us access to their lands for military use, we protect them, and then we give them some kind of modest, you know, economic benefits. And interestingly enough, just last week, Congress passed the legislation to actually renew the Compact of Free Association, because that is not a permanent relationship. It's something that's negotiated for, I think, you know, 15-year periods or 20-year periods or something like that, and it has to be renewed by Congress. And for, you know, several years, those compacts have been up core renewal, and Congress had basically just been sitting on them without, you know, approving them. And thankfully, for their benefit and for ours, the Congress finally got around to doing that last week.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
When I think about the statehood option, I naturally think back to a long time ago where the last two places that weren't states became states, right? Alaska in 1958, before they became a state, something like 83% of Alaskans voted in favor of statehood in their own plebiscite. And then a year later, something like over 94% of Hawaiians voted for statehood. And I guess when I compare what I think I know, at least what I've been told about how Puerto Ricans feel about statehood, those numbers are very different. At least what I've seen is we don't see anything like those kind of overwhelming numbers. And so I think some people would look at those cases and say, well, that's why Puerto Rico isn't a state yet, because we don't see almost everyone wanting to do that. And we don't want to force people, nearly half of a population, into statehood against their will. And so can you talk a little bit about how I'm sure it's more complex than that, but how Puerto Ricans feel about statehood and how you kind of understand those situations?
Yeah, I think the narrative that you paint is kind of a common perspective that, you know, is understandable why people would kind of see it that way. But the historic reality in the case of Alaska and Hawaii is just a little bit more nuanced than that. And you actually have to look at their statehood admission process. So Alaska and Hawaii first petitioned for statehood many decades before their process of admission finally took place. And, you know, there were a number of different bills that were presented on it. But locally, the legislature in Hawaii also passed local plebiscites where they asked their residents whether or not they wanted to be admitted as a state. And the percentages that of approval for that were more than the majority. So they were past 50%. And I don't remember off the top of my head exactly what they were. I think it was like in the, you know, upper 50s for one of them, and then in the lower, you know, 60s or something for the other. But when Congress finally got around to actually passing the legislation that formally offered them admission, set out the terms of what admission as a state would look like for them, and then asked the citizens there to ratify that admission offer, the percentage of support in both jurisdictions went way up. And the reason for that is very simple. When it's the local government asking you that as a poll, it, you know, it's important information to have, but it doesn't actually guarantee that the result will be enacted into law and made a reality. Whereas when Congress offers it, there is that guarantee. And so the certainty of voters that they are actually going to get what they ask for goes up, and there's a higher amount of participation and obviously, you know, bigger support for statehood, which is what we saw in the case of Alaska and Hawaii. So I think that that's kind of the historic perspective. And I don't think that Puerto Rico will vary from that almost at all, except for the reality of what I mentioned, that Puerto Rico is considered this unincorporated territory, whereas Alaska and Hawaii were incorporated, meaning that Alaska and Hawaii didn't have an option other than statehood or staying a territory. Puerto Rico still theoretically has the option of becoming an independent country or achieving independence through free association. But what we see,
I was just wondering that, I guess I'm just having trouble understanding what would be, because I know there's some sort of an organized opposition movement in Puerto Rico to that. But when I look at the benefits potentially of statehood compared to the status quo, it's just sort of hard for me to grasp why there would be any significant organized opposition. And maybe you could help me understand this a little bit.
Sure. So I'll quickly run you through the results of the last plebiscite and then kind of the last few plebiscites and then kind of explain the views of the opposition. So there's been a total of 5 different locally held plebiscites in Puerto Rico. The 3 most recent ones are in 2012, 2017, and 2020. And in 2012, voters were asked whether or not they wanted to stay under the current territory status. A majority of 54% said no. And they were asked, which non-territorial alternative do you prefer? And I think it was like 62% said statehood. Free association got about a third of the vote, and independence got the rest. And then in 2017, voters were asked again, this time whether they wanted statehood, independence with or without free association, or to remain under the current territory status. And the opposition parties, those who support continuing a territory or making it better somehow, or who support independence or free association, they saw the polling leading up to the plebiscite. They were going to get wiped out with, I think, over 60-some percent supporting. And they decided to just boycott it and try to use their lack of participation as a way of denying the validity of that exercise. And statehood came out with like 97% support, which was exceedingly high. But obviously, those who boycotted claimed that, you know, the plebiscite was illegitimate, and then they try to kind of, you know, throw the baby out with the bathwater in terms of making the argument that because they didn't participate, then the vote doesn't matter, even though there's no election in the world anywhere where when you don't participate, you get to decide that the election doesn't matter. But, you know, that's another story for another day. And then in 2020, after we've had those 2 plebiscites where a majority rejected the territory status and favored statehood, we got feedback from Congress that it was clear that Puerto Ricans don't want to continue being a territory, but it wasn't clear whether there was an absolute majority for statehood. So we decided to go in the same route as Alaska and Hawaii and just ask voters, do you want statehood? Yes or no? And 52.5% or something like that, almost 53% voted yes for statehood. And that's what happened in 2020. And that's been, you know, the motivator for Congress to deal with and present that legislation that you mentioned and all the progress that's kind of happening on the issue now. Now, going back to why would people oppose statehood, you know, it really has to do with the nature of the colonial territorial relationship. There is a significant segment of the population in Puerto Rico who have been led to believe that when Puerto Rico achieved becoming a commonwealth in 1953, that had changed its territory status. In reality, what we've found out through Supreme Court cases as recent as 2016, Sanchez Valle, another one called Aurelius, another one called Valle Madero, is that irrespective of the fact that we had a locally approved constitution in 1953 that Congress authorized us to do, and it was called the Commonwealth or Estado Libre Asociado in Spanish, that we had not achieved sovereignty and self-governance, that essentially the sovereignty of Puerto Rico rests exclusively within Congress. So a lot of people had been for, you know, a long time. I mean, 1953 is, decades ago. Still, they believed that we had achieved some kind of self-governance. And they were told that as much by a number of different politicians, both locally and federally. So they were misled to think that that was somehow a new kind of, you know, form of equality and a different form of sovereignty, and that the relationship wasn't, you know, territorial colonialism. And now we know that that's just not true, right? So that's one reason. And then the other reason is because there has been for many, many, many decades, a small but very loud and vocal group of people in Puerto Rico whose personal beliefs are that Puerto Ricans can never exercise the full extent of their personal cultural identity, linguistic identity, as a territory or under statehood, and that it's absolutely essential for Puerto Rico's survival as a people and as a culture and as a society to have a separate form of governance through independence. And traditionally, independence supporters in Puerto Rico have had, I think at their peak in the 1920s and 30s, they had about 20 to 30% electoral support. There was a long period of time in which the federal government basically suppressed those people. The FBI had COINTELPRO program where they basically investigated and harassed and did all kinds of things, all in the name of fighting communism, because many of the independent supporters allied themselves with more kind of left-wing, you know, socialist and communist views. And they've gotten support from the communist regime in Cuba and Venezuela and, you know, Nicaragua and other places. So, you know, there was a lot of concern there. But all of that suppression and frankly, in many cases, you know, instances where, you know, they were, you know, persecuted and violently so, a lot of the independent supporters, you know, left the island, and support for that option, you know, waned significantly, but never fully went away. And for those people, they have an active psychological and emotional trauma around the relationship with the United States because they weren't allowed to have their political views seen and heard. And they hold that to this day. And you know, we have a challenge, which is how do we, you know, recognize as Americans, you know, the wrongs that we did and provide an opportunity for those people to have their, you know, views heard and valued, but at the same time, allow the will of the majority of the voters to be the one that prevails in finally deciding and resolving this issue, and hopefully finding a way of doing that that allows for kind of healing and reconciliation in society, where if Puerto Rico does choose statehood by a majority, where that can be accepted by everyone else who doesn't favor that option, and we can find a way to integrate them and kind of, you know, bring the society back into a state of coherence.
This is also, though, not just a Puerto Rico issue. This is also a sort of a partisan issue in U.S. domestic politics, because Republicans typically believe what Puerto Rico statehood would mean is two more safe Democratic seats in the Senate. I think something like four safe Democratic House seats, six electoral votes that would likely go for Democrats. And so Republicans, I think, just strategically looking at this, say, well, heck no, we're not going to vote for even pushing forward something that might put us at a longer term electoral disadvantage. And I'm wondering what you, how you respond to that sort of political calculus argument.
Well, I think the first thing that I would say is that I understand why they're looking at it from that perspective, sure, because really they're not looking at the fact that these are our fellow American citizens and that, you know, in a country that touts itself as, you know, as a democracy, as a beacon of freedom, as beacon of, you know, hope in the world, because we, you know, are showing a way to govern ourselves where everyone has a say in the government that they're a part of, they're really kind of othering and excluding fellow citizens on the island that contribute greatly to America. So, you know, that's deeply frustrating. But if you, you know, go into the actual analysis of the facts behind their assumptions, you also realize that they're just factually inaccurate and wrong, right? So the assumption by Republicans that if Puerto Rico were a state, we'd automatically have two U.S. senators that are Democrats and four representatives that are Democrats is just not actually sustainable if you look at the voting patterns of Puerto Ricans on the island. So I've worked for Republican governor, Governor Luis Fortuño. I've worked for a Democratic governor, Governor Ricardo Rosselló, and our current governor, Pedro Pierluisi, who is a very moderate Democrat. I worked for him when he was in the House of Representatives as Puerto Rico's resident commissioner. The thing that they all had in common is that they all supported statehood for Puerto Rico. So voters on the island are not aligned politically based on the conservative or liberal viewpoints or Democrat or Republican viewpoints. They're aligned based on their opinions and views on political status. Now, that's starting to change, right? So traditionally in Puerto Rico, there's been the small pro-independence party, which I mentioned represents that kind of, you know, small movement that supports independence for Puerto Rico. The traditional kind of pro-Commonwealth party, which, you know, thought that, you know, Puerto Rico had achieved something other than territory status when our local constitution was approved, and their, you know, their numbers have fallen significantly, because now that everyone knows that that's not true, it's only the most hardcore, you know, supporters that are kind of still hanging on to the party as a vehicle for getting elected that are kind of, you know, still supporting it. But otherwise, they have no ideological, like, north in terms of where they actually want Puerto Rico as a society to go. And then the other party has been the pro-statehood party, which has always recognized that, you know, over 98% of Puerto Ricans love and want to keep their U.S. citizenship and want to have, you know, as many rights and opportunities as possible under that. And that the only way to achieve full equality and democracy as U.S. citizens under the U.S. constitutional framework is to become a state, right? So those have been the three traditional parties: pro-independence, pro-Commonwealth, and then the pro-statehood party. But recently, what we've seen is that now there is a youth, you know, led labor movement led progressive left party called the Citizens Victory Movement. And they're very much kind of in line with the American Democratic Progressive Left. And then you've had a Christian conservative party, the Dignity Project, that has come up, and they're very much aligned with, you know, Christian conservative values that you would normally identify with the Republican Party. And even in the pro-statehood party, which is the largest and highest vote-getting party on the island right now, you have both Democrats and Republicans. Our current governor is a Democrat, but our resident commissioner, who is from the same party and now, you know, in a primary with the governor, Jennifer Gonzalez, she's a Republican. So what we see is that on the island, you've had officials elected to the highest offices, the governorship, as resident commissioner, and as, you know, majority leaders in the local House and Senate, that have identified at different points as both Democrats and Republicans at the national level. So this idea that Puerto Rico would only be Democrats can only be put forward by people who either don't know the facts or they're purposefully misrepresenting them in order to gain favor with an uninformed electorate stateside who they think that they can rile up based on making these false assumptions.
Now, there would also be economic or policy implications of statehood. I think there's a general view that, okay, if it's Puerto Rican statehood, then Puerto Ricans will be paying more in income tax, in taxes to the federal government, but still it would be a net loss. You take a look at, like, for instance, Puerto Rico's GDP per capita. It's way less than even the poorest U.S. state, which is Mississippi. And the poverty rate is something like double that of Mississippi. And I've seen some estimates that suggest that this could end up costing the federal government somewhere between, I don't know, $5 to $10 billion per year on an ongoing basis. And so what's your take on that sort of economic analysis?
Yeah, I think it's really, really important to have this conversation and to look at this, not just from the perspective of Puerto Rico specifically, which I think is important to look into, but also from a historic perspective. If we look at Utah, New Mexico, Arizona, which were, you know, some of the states that were admitted closer to the beginning of the 20th century, and then Alaska and Hawaii, which were admitted to statehood in 1959, what we see is a pattern of a underperformance economically in that jurisdiction under the territory status, because inevitably, when you're treated unequally and you have an unequal playing field, you're not going to be able to perform at your full economic potential because you're getting less federal support for your infrastructure, for your healthcare, for, you know, all of these different areas that are the basic, you know, framework on which economic opportunities are built locally, right? And when those jurisdictions became states, you see a phenomenon that economists have described as economic convergence, where the trajectory of growth of the territory, once it becomes a state, begins to align itself with the national average of economic growth. And they experience maybe a decade or two of higher than usual growth as they kind of come into their kind of, you know, greater level of alignment with the rate of national growth, right? And that has to do with both the equal treatment under federal laws and programs, but also the economic certainty that statehood brings, right? So as a, you know, an unincorporated territory right now, you know, if you think about, you know, large companies or even individuals, you know, making investments on the island, they run the risk that at any point in the future, Puerto Rico could still possibly become an independent country, or that it could be treated, you know, differently by Congress in any federal law. Because even with the federal laws where Puerto Rico is currently treated equally right now, the U.S. Supreme Court has decided that if Congress decides to change its mind, it can do so. So even if we have statutory equality for the time being, at a point in the future, you know, Congress can say, oh, well, we've decided to change that. And, you know, now we're going to treat you worse for, you know, whatever reason. And what that does is it creates economic uncertainty. And economic uncertainty is literally, and political uncertainty, and that is literally the enemy of, you know, the potential for investors to kind of, you know, go all out in knowing that the place they're invested in and investing in is going to be, you know, stable and able to, you know, develop to its full potential. So I think that that's the historic backdrop that we've seen with the other jurisdictions. And right now, Puerto Rico has gone through a process of debt restructuring because in 2016, Congress was forced to pass legislation called PROMESA, which basically established a fiscal oversight board over the island to essentially monitor its finances and do so in a way that unfortunately widened the democratic deficit. So now it's not just that Puerto Ricans can't vote for members of Congress and can't vote for the president, but they also don't vote for seven unelected officials that get to override the decisions by the current governor and the elected legislature when it comes to fiscal and budgetary matters on the island. And that's crazy. That couldn't happen under statehood. And that's obviously been extremely challenging locally. But there have been some benefits to the establishment of the oversight board. One is that Puerto Rico has been able to restructure about 80% of its debt to more manageable levels that are able to be repaid. And then it has also vastly improved the fiscal transparency and clarity with which Puerto Rico's finances operate, which was something that was desperately needed on the island. So now that, you know, we're kind of nearing the tail end of that process, and we've had, unfortunately, since Hurricanes Irma and Maria in 2017 devastated the island, we've had this huge injection of federal disaster recovery dollars to help kind of rebuild the infrastructure. After then, we've had a period where unemployment on the island has come to some of its lowest rates in decades. We've experienced positive economic growth, and Puerto Rico is basically kind of positioned for an economic takeoff, but it won't ever reach its full potential unless you deal with the fundamental problem of territorial inequality, because you create a cumulative effect of unequal treatment in the economy when you invest less in roads, in, you know, healthcare, in, you know, elderly care, in, you know, education, and, you know, all of these different areas. And that means that, you know, there aren't as many opportunities. There's not as much money flowing in the economy. And ultimately, people want to leave to come stateside where they can get, you know, full access to their rights and those benefits. And when you lose population, you lose your consumer base, you lose your tax base, and you lose your workforce talent. And tell me one economy in the whole world that can grow under those circumstances.
You know, it also occurs to me that the fact that Puerto Rico doesn't have real representation in Congress means that there's no one that's advocating in a meaningful way for federal investment. I guess I'm thinking about this because not too long ago, I was reading about the state of Alabama and former senators. Shelby there just was able to push hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars of FBI funding money. And I'm thinking, well, Puerto Rico doesn't have anyone who can do that, who can be that person who works on the Appropriations Committee and gets that in there. And so that's an incredibly big comparative disadvantage, I would think.
Definitely. Definitely. And you see it play out in a number of different ways. You know, you see it play out in terms of less federal contracting dollars going to companies in Puerto Rico. And there's companies in Puerto Rico that are qualified to do a lot of that work. We graduate amazingly good engineers, so much so that NASA, Boeing, Northrop Grumman, heck, even the NSA go to Puerto Rico to recruit our engineers and bring them stateside to do, you know, top work in all kinds of different, you know, fields of development. You know, why don't we have more companies in Puerto Rico that are able to absorb that, you know, talent that we're cultivating on the island that clearly our people have the capacity to do? Well, you know, one of the issues is that, you know, having a member of Congress helps get more federal contracting dollars to your jurisdiction. That's something that's a well-known reality, whether people want to accept it as a good practice or not. That's another question, but it's just something that inevitably happens. The other thing is we get less, you know, federal workforce on the island in many different ways than, you know, other places. I mean, is there a direct correlation between, for example, the IRS having some of its, you know, key offices in Kentucky and the senator from Kentucky being some of the most powerful senators in the United States Senate? I think not. That there's a direct correlation there, right? And Puerto Rico obviously doesn't have any senators, and no resident commissioner of Puerto Rico or territorial delegate from anywhere has ever been either on the Ways and Means Committee or the Appropriations Committee. So we're basically having to beg other members to represent our jurisdiction. And, you know, many times there's friendly faces there. But whenever, you know, there's a conflict or a priority between prioritizing the voters in their district or in their state versus the needs of the U.S. citizens in the territories, you better believe that the U.S. territories are going to be left behind.
Yeah, it's hard to horse trade. We know anything to offer in way of a vote, basically. I mean,
exactly. Yeah.
So I guess right now it seems to me that, I mean, this legislation has kind of been in committee for a long time now. It's not looking good. And generally speaking, I would say it seems to me in the short term, the environment is not such that we can expect anything within the next year or so. But obviously you are optimistic or you wouldn't be doing what you're doing. So help me understand what you think needs to change in the environment for this to become, for Puerto Rican statehood to become likely or more likely than it is now.
Yeah, no, I think you're asking a super fair question. And the reality is that it's not just the issue of resolving Puerto Rico's territory status that right now is not moving through Congress. Almost anything is not moving through Congress right now. They can literally just barely pass, you know, these continuing resolutions to keep the lights on in Congress. But otherwise, the vast majority of substantive issues in any given area are basically stuck in the hopper right now with the way that Congress is operating. And it's not surprising, just given the fact that we're in election year and the level of partisan bickering and conflict has consensually ground America's policy agenda to a halt. So in that circumstance, what we've focused on is continuing to cultivate support for this legislation among members of Congress by getting co-sponsors for our bill, which you mentioned earlier in the House. And then obviously the House was able to pass this a version of this bill in 2022 when the Democrats were in the majority. It got unanimous support from Democrats, ended up getting 16 votes from Republicans, which to me feels miraculous because, you know, they were only 2 weeks away from, you know, taking over the House. So, you know, the Republicans who voted on this clearly stood on principle and really wanted to support this issue. And it got a statement of administration policy from the Biden administration. So you've got two of the three entities that need to approve this to essentially give it a green light. With Republicans in control of the House now, we haven't even been able to get a committee hearing. We're still pushing for that possibility and have hope that the current chairman, Mr. Westerman, is able and willing to do that. When he spoke on the floor during the bill passage, he said, "Hey, I'm not against self-determination for Puerto Rico. I support that. I'm just against the way that Democrats did this particular bill and they negotiated it." And my view is, if that's the case, now that you're chairman, you know, like, right, let's hold a hearing so that, you know, you can have whichever Republican views you felt were not represented in that process represented. And we can kind of, you know, hear what you have to say and integrate that either into improving the bill or in creating a new legislative vehicle. So that's where we're at in the House. And then the real development during this session has been in the Senate. So there hadn't been a hearing on this issue in the Senate since 2013. And now, for the first time, we have, you know, 23, almost a quarter of the U.S. Senate basically coming on to this bill and saying, we don't think America should continue holding colonies. Let's offer voters in Puerto Rico the constitutionally available choices. And my sense is that it's likely that there will be hearings about this issue in the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee, particularly now that Senator Manchin has kind of announced that he's going to be retiring at the end of this session. I think that there's less kind of, you know, resistance from him. And that's going to be significant because what that does is it moves us forward an opportunity to push for additional senators to become aware of this issue, to get involved in it, and hopefully then kind of build a record of support for this so that, you know, whatever happens in 2024, maybe there's a window of opportunity to move this ball all the way downfield. And if it isn't in 2024, then, you know, after that. But sooner or later, there is going to be a window of opportunity for Congress to pass this legislation and for the American people at large, not just people in Puerto Rico, to say, hey, Congress, you know, enough is enough. You know, you're holding these fellow citizens under this political subordination of territorial colonialism on our behalf. And that's not good. We as a country don't stand for that. And let's stop the colony and let Puerto Rico decide.
Well, on that, what I would say is a realistically optimistic note. I think we'll close. George Laws Garcia, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today.
No, thank you, Michael. It's been a pleasure. And if I may, I would love for any of your listeners who want to find out more information about the work that we do at the Puerto Rico Statehood Council to visit our website. It's pr51st.com. We're also on YouTube, Instagram, Twitter, and other places. So we'd love to have your supporters come out, check out our website, and hopefully sign up and be a part of this movement, because it's not just about Puerto Rico. It's really about America coming into integrity with our founding values. And I think that's something that is important to the health of our democracy as a whole.
Absolutely. And we will make sure to include that link in the show notes.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Michael.
Thanks for listening to this Politics Guys interview. If you're not already a supporter of the show, I hope you'll consider becoming one, because without our supporters, we wouldn't be able to do this. And when you become a supporter, you get not just that warm, fuzzy feeling, knowing that you're supporting a good cause. I like to think we're a good cause. But you also get stuff like ad-free versions of everything we put out. You get our supporter-exclusive midweek show, the full length of that, not just the preview. And you also get to be part of our Discord group if you want. And there's always some interesting conversations going on there. At the $10 a month level or more, you get to actually be part of the episodes Jay and I do, if that's something you're interested in. So there's a lot of stuff, is what I am saying. And I hope you'll consider checking it out. And to do that, just go to patreon.com/politicsguys. If you want to support us on Venmo, we're at Politics Guys. You can also support the show through PayPal. And all of our support links are always in the show notes, as well as at politicsguys.com/support. And as always, I want to close with a very special thank you to our wonderful executive producers, Bruce Johnson, Wilmer Moreno, Daniel Toe, Ryan Beasley, and Don Oglesby.